Dave McGrath. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is up next.
Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And you are about to hear over WGTD a very, very familiar voice to Wisconsin Public Radio listeners in this part of the state and throughout the state for that matter, Kathleen Dunn, who is part of the sister network, the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, but about to call it quits. Thursday is her final show. She is about to retire after a long and successful career in radio, many years with Wisconsin Public Radio, and before that, many years on commercial radio as well. So one of the most familiar and admired voices here in southeastern Wisconsin. And I'm very, very happy that she makes a few minutes out of her very busy schedule schedule available for a conversation on today's morning show. Kathleen Dunn, I'm honored to welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. Thanks for the kind words.
I don't know very much about your career before Wisconsin Public Radio. Can you say a quick word about how you first got interested in the medium of radio and what your most significant experiences were before Wisconsin Public Radio?
Well, I started, Greg, I used to work for WGN in Chicago. I went to the University of Iowa, and I would do internships, but I'd be there in the summer and during breaks from school in the script typing department. That ages me. The script typing, we used typewriters, and I typed commercials for Wally Phillips, who was a big name.
Oh, yes.
Chicago celebrity years and years ago. I never really thought of going into radio at that time because there simply weren't, during those years, many women who were in radio. We weren't there. We weren't present at all. I did a Broadway show tune hour a couple times a week at the University of Iowa on the campus radio station, which nobody liked, but I had a really good time playing Broadway show tunes, which I love to this day. And then I kind of meandered into radio. I'm trained as a teacher, a high school teacher of English and drama. And I was driving around the country in a beat-up old VW car that broke down in Ohio, and I had to borrow some money from my mother to get it fixed. And so I was on my way to San Francisco via New York, via the South, all over the country. And I got to North Carolina, where my brother was going to school, and got a job at a radio station. And I just loved it. It was a very small station, and we did all kinds of rather eccentric programming. We had a women's radio hour. It was during the Watergate years, so we were very carefully covering what was going on with Watergate and doing a lot of news. And I just loved the medium so much. And from there, I went to WTMJ and was an affirmative action hiring. They were looking for women in those years, and spent 18 years at the station doing a religious radio program, doing a talk show, very early mornings, Saturday mornings. I don't know if anybody was listening, but I had a heck of a good time. And then eventually moved to nighttime programming on TMJ and then to daytime programming. So, and doing essentially the same kind of work there that I do now. It was long-form interviews. And it's amazing that I've been able to do this for so many years.
Did anything in particular prompt your leap from commercial radio to public radio, and specifically to Wisconsin Public Radio, other than maybe a job offer, or is this an opening that you went after yourself?
It was an opening. The station, the commercial station, was changing direction and going to host opinionated talk, which was not what I did. And so I was looking at public radio at that point because I love doing, and the audience deserved to have access to and conversations with some people who were worth listening to. And they're not always big-name people. They're people who are living in poverty and have had violence affect their neighborhoods and are trying to make a difference. People like Studs Terkel, I loved interviewing him, Maya Angelou, just a lot of people who had very good things to say. And so you build a community of people who appreciate hearing those people and then also had a chance to interact with them via call-ins, which has always been a big part of my show. The audience enhances the show enormously and have made incredible contributions to each and every conversation. So it was a natural fit for me to go to a station that was going a different direction to go to public radio, which I always admired, and I had a chance to do it.
Did you take calls on your talk programs with WTMJ?
Yes.
And then what kind of difference did you sense as you made the shift from WTMJ to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio in terms of the kind of listeners from whom you were hearing through the course of the program? Or was it largely the same kind of citizens of Wisconsin?
Some of it was the same, I'd say, Greg. Some of it was a little different. I'm always astounded by, no matter how narrow a topic may appear, that you find somebody in the audience who can add this enormous amount of information and add to the conversation. Or people who knew, I'm reminded of a couple interviews, one with Senator Bob Dole, and he got a call. He grew up in a very small Kansas town, and he got a call from somebody who knew his family and knew him and knew his father. Years and years ago, he had grown up just a couple houses down the block. Well, what are the chances of somebody listening to Senator Dole on that particular day and being able to offer these memories of his father? So many of these really touched us. They touched our souls, and you know, that just doesn't happen very often. And it's because people, I think, go to public radio who have these wealth of experiences and these very rich pasts and experiences themselves and bring it to whoever the guest happens to be. And that's happened time and time again.
For those of you just joining us, although she needs no introduction for the vast majority of you, I'm speaking right now with Kathleen Dunn, who, of course, is one of the most well-known, immediately recognized voices on our sister network, the Ideas Network, and she is about to retire. Thursday is her final program. Kathleen Dunn, can you take us through what a typical day would be in terms of your preparation for a given show? And we should mention that you are on the air 2 hours every day, and typically it's, in a sense, two different programs back to back. How does your preparation typically unfold?
I was always the kid in high school who came home with all these books. I was a very serious student because I never wanted to appear to be stupid, and so I prepare heavily for all of my shows, Greg. I mean, it's a luxury. I get to read books, and I'm keeping up on what's going on politically in the country, and I do a lot of homework for the program. So we have always, over the years, I've had marvelous producers, and they need to be given all the credit in the world. I never could do this show without fine creative minds behind the scenes who worked very, very hard and had areas of interest that were beyond what I would normally think of. So together we would collaborate each morning and figure out what was in the news, because the first hour has always been very timely. And then what books are out, what can we talk about culturally, what about families, what about school, etc. We all brought our own special interest to the show and then went beyond that because we were all avid readers and consumers of media, mostly books and newspapers and magazines. We followed a lot of people, and we just developed over the years a number of very good contacts with a number of national people, very good political analysts nationally, and I pride myself on being able to do those kinds of shows on a regular basis. So we would get together and brainstorm, and then if you're doing a breaking news show, sometimes, particularly the last year, you've been keeping up with what's happening on a moment-by-moment basis. so that you're up to date with all the information. So that happens in the morning, and we record billboards, we call them, to let people know what we're talking about. And then after the show, it's right into the next day. So I've been spending some time listening to old shows, which I've never had the luxury to do because it's always the next thing, the next thing. And it was kind of fun to hear some of these people again. I mean, sad in a way because some of them are gone now, but I realized how wonderful to have all these people on the air, and they were so worth listening to. And then you go home at night, and you'd have, sometimes I was doing two books a week for a number of years, and so you'd be reading constantly, and again, reading the newspapers and reading blogs and going to all kinds of different sources to become informed about something so you could bring something that was new, that was not being rehashed all the time on other media, and use a variety of sources for that. So it was a lot of, I don't want to call it work, Greg, because it was always a pleasure to be able to do this. It really is like going to school every day, year after year after year after year, and learning so much. But it's not an easy job. It required, for me at least, maybe other people could do it without the preparation, but I was trained in high school, you got to know what you're talking about.
Oh, absolutely. And of course, one thing I always say to people who, a guest that appreciates the prep that I've done rather than just asking them generic questions,
right,
is that it not only makes it more interesting for the listeners, but it ultimately makes it much more interesting for me, that bluffing your way through with just what you've gleaned from the dust jacket of a book might be easier, but oh so much more boring, not just for the listeners or for the guest, but for me as the host.
Right.
And it's just a richer experience for everyone.
Absolutely.
I appreciated when you recently interviewed James Traub, who has written a groundbreaking biography of our sixth president, John Quincy Adams.
Yeah,
I remember,
oh, I'm glad you liked
that. I did, and I remember something in your opening where you said something to the effect, how many people on the whole face of the planet are going to spend the next hour delving into the life of John Quincy Adams. And I think that not only was, you know, mildly amusing, but it also spoke to the sense of gratitude with which you have done this work over all these many years.
Absolutely. We did a lot of shows like that. But the thing is, there are a whole lot of people who are interested in the life of John Quincy Adams. It's just that nobody's afforded them the opportunity to talk about it on the radio. We did so many presidential biographies. And as you know, I'm a huge Lincoln fan. That's what I'm going to do in retirement. I'm going back to Abraham Lincoln. I've read a ton about him, but I'm going to do even more. And we did some obscure presidents. We did all kinds of presidents. And I think the audience really appreciated that. There's a hunger for history. There's a hunger for going beyond what the news is today. I think we're living in difficult times right now, and it's wonderful to go back to other times in history and to learn from that. We have to inform ourselves about what our ideals are, what America is, what democracy is, what our role is in all of that. And by golly, you've got the audience they're members of the democracy in every sense of the word.
Absolutely. I wonder how often, if ever, have you interviewed an author with a perspective very different than your own versus someone who has written a book and as you've read it, you've thought, hear, I agree with this completely. I'm so glad he wrote this, he or she wrote this, versus someone who has written a book which offers a perspective profoundly different from your own. How often have you had that experience with your program, and to what extent has that altered the way in which you would, for instance, conduct that kind of interview versus with someone who is, in a sense, much more on your own personal page, philosophically,
right,
or politically or otherwise?
I think that's happened more often than not with books necessarily, because we've, I think, chosen to highlight the important and the good. And so when it comes to presidential biographies, we've done more interviews with people who have written about substantial figures in American history, those who have lasted and whose contributions have lasted. It's happened more often with me with doing the All Things Political show. We've done tons and tons of political shows. And there are many people with whom I have disagreed, but I have learned from them. We find people who are even-handed about the way they approach things, so that healthcare has been something that we've spent hours and hours and hours on over the past 8 years, actually. And we had a variety of perspectives on this, from people who believed that we should have our own personal health savings accounts to others who thought that we needed a single-payer system in the country. And I've learned from all of those people. What I've learned, I guess, is the variety of opinion in this country, that we do need to be civil with each other, and we are so not that at this moment. We just yell at each other and we don't listen to another point of view. I have very strong points of view, as you might imagine, on a number of issues, but I am respectful and understand that there's a need for us to hear each other, because we're not always going to get what we want.
That speaks to another question I wanted to ask you. When recently you interviewed historian David McCullough, who is, of course, a very respected figure, about his latest book, which is something about the American spirit. It's not a book I haven't seen yet. But in the course of introducing him for that program, which aired very recently, actually, you said something to the effect of how reassured you felt as you read this book, because you've been, I think the word you used was rattled, because of feeling sort of rattled by recent events or the current landscape, or I don't remember exactly the rest of the sentence, but I remember the word rattled. I wonder if you could say a word about that state of mind, that you're certainly not the only person who might be feeling that, but perhaps it was just what you were speaking about just now that leaves you feeling kind of somewhat rattled about the state of affairs in our country right now.
Well, I'm very upset that we don't speak to each other. I'm very upset that there doesn't seem to be a strong sense of history, of learning from fine minds, from people who have gone before us. I'm concerned that we're denigrating the press, that people in the administration are denigrating the press, when it's so important to have a vibrant free press in this country. It's just so important. I'm concerned that there is a demonization of people who are other, and that there are people who are hurting as a result of that. There are people who have come here just to make a better life for their families. And I know this is a complicated issue. Immigration is a complicated issue. But I just feel for the human beings behind some of these stories, because, you know, we talk to some of these human beings. We don't always talk to authors of books. We speak with people who have been victims of violence, who have lost loved ones in the central city in Milwaukee, and an issue that just hasn't been fully addressed for so many years now. So we hear the human stories of people who are working on minimum wage jobs and trying to make a living. And in a way, we had a sense, I think, of the rise of both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, because we heard from a lot of people and understood that there were people who just weren't making it, who didn't get enough money to put food on the table or even think about college for their kids or health care, because we're in touch with many of those people. And those voices don't make their way to the media. You just don't see people. And if you hear their stories, you realize the angst that's out there and how some politicians may be able to court those people, because if they're speaking, they may not follow through on what solutions there are to help people, but somebody's speaking to what those issues are. I'm just concerned that we've got media that's more right. It's left as well, but we don't have the kind of Edward R. Murrow, the kind of Walter Cronkite, the people who Michael Harrington, who looked at poverty in this country, Bobby Kennedy, people like that who seem to have a heart. I guess I'm worried that we've lost our hearts.
Is it difficult to step away from this important platform at such a moment, when you feel like this kind of serious and thoughtful journalism is, in a sense, a state of retreat? Does that make stepping away harder, or, in a sense, does it make it easier? Or does it have nothing to do at all with this decision to retire?
Well, I think that there is serious journalism. Certainly what public radio is doing is a godsend to the country. It is so important in these days. Plus, there are all kinds of publications, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Atlantic. There are all kinds of very serious, wonderful journalists who are out there. I guess it's more what's happening with with cable television that concerns me, and that we're using Twitter in little sentences instead of a deep exploration of issues that have a lot of nuances to them. And there are places to find that nuance. In terms of where the political discourse is, Greg, I haven't lived in a time like this, and I must tell you that it is hard to talk about these issues sometimes, that there's a lot behind the headlines, but I also would like the leadership to be perhaps better informed about what some of the issues are. It's hard. It's hard to pay a lot of attention. I'd rather pay attention, if you want to know my opinion on this, to people like Abraham Lincoln and George Washington and FDR and you know, even Richard Nixon, where there was some substance. I want substance. And you could find it. It's not that it's not there. It's there. But it's not finding its way to be a part of the national discourse on issues. Right. So, no, I'm ready. You know, I'm old now, too, and I want to raise a puppy. So I want to do something else with my life, too. Maybe I'll listen to some old shows.
There you go. Well, you certainly have the right to do that. Let me ask you one more quick question.
Sure.
I know you need to go. One of the things I remember most vividly when I think about your voice, I mean, besides memorable programs, some of which I even called into, one of your visits with Robert Reich, I was the first caller.
Greg.
He'd written a memoir about his time in the Clinton cabinet,
yes.
And I was the first caller. I just went on and on about how much I loved it. Well, and it was funny because when Robert Reich came on then after I was done, he said, I want everyone to know I have not paid Greg. I don't know Greg, but, you know, this is what every author wants to hear. But so I have lots of positive memories. But one of my most vivid memories of your voice is actually in one of those little promotional spots, not for any particular program, but just in general about Wisconsin Public Radio, where you said, I remember the words vividly, we are thorough and fair.
Right.
We are thorough and fair. And it struck me as words that were very, very well chosen because you could make a lot of other high-sounding pronouncements about Wisconsin Public Radio or any other media outlet that probably wouldn't be exactly true. I mean, like perfectly unbiased or whatever. I mean, things that are very difficult, if impossible, to achieve. But I thought you said it so very, very well in terms of what most organs of public radio are all about. What is your feeling of what it has meant to be thorough and fair?
I love that. And that's what we are. And where do you find that? We are thorough. When you think, Greg, about all that we talk about in the course of a day on this network, it is phenomenal. It's just remarkable. And I think that we all have points of view. So the listeners have points of view. We all have points of view about issues. And if you're deeply immersed in all these conversations and in politics and history and all of that, you have thoughts about it. We're human beings. We are members of a democracy. We all think deeply about things. But we can be... My husband called me, which I think is a real high compliment, and I think people know this about me. He said that what you are is a feisty progressive, but you are incredibly fair. And that's who I am. I mean, that really is who I am. I'm progressive on a lot of issues. I have admiration for people people like Studs Terkel, you know, who has been a hero of mine in my life. But I also listen to people who maybe are very conservative about issues. I'm fair to people, and that's who we are. And this thing about being totally unbiased, I do a talk show, so it's not that you're totally unbiased. There are issues that are, and there are certain kinds of issues that are very important to me. I'm concerned about race. I won't allow racism to go unnoticed. I will call out certain things that just don't have any place, I think, in American discourse and all we've fought for and all people have died for in this country, for heaven's sake. But we can entertain because we have, obviously, different points of view. And so we need to listen. I think listening, we're fair, we're feisty, and we are listening. And we listen. That's important. We listen.
Absolutely. And I want to say that one of the things I've so admired as I've listened to your program is not only your thoughtful interaction with your guests, but also your thoughtful and also sensitive interaction with your listeners calling in. And, of course, that's the great wild card.
Exactly.
And that's what makes the show probably once in a while a little bit unsettling and certainly unpredictable, but also so much richer.
Yes, and fun, too. I like that element of the show. You don't know exactly where you're going when you turn that mic on.
Absolutely. Well, Kathleen Dunn, you have lots of fans, and I am one of them, and we wish you a very happy and fulfilling retirement, and we thank you for all the good work that you have done all these many years with Wisconsin Public Radio, and I thank you for being part of the morning show today. Best
wishes.
Thank
you so much. Thanks, Greg. I appreciate it. All the best to you.
Kathleen Dunn's program airs over Wisconsin Public Radio from 1 to 3 every weekday afternoon, Monday through Thursday. Her very last program with Wisconsin Public Radio will be tomorrow. My thanks again to Kathleen Dunn for making time in her very busy schedule to be part of the morning show. Part 2 is coming up in just a moment. I am very excited to be speaking with a real-life hero today on the morning show. His name is Eric Weihenmayer, and I'm sure many of you know his name, and with good reason. Eric Weihenmayer has been to the summit of Mount Everest, and it so happens that he is the first and still only blind person to ever reach that summit. Not only that, he has climbed the highest peaks of all 7 continents. He has led a group of blind young Tibetans 21,000 feet up the face of Mount Everest and accomplished a whole lot of other things. In fact, some people would say teaching middle school for 6 years was probably an accomplishment roughly akin to scaling Mount Everest. His most recent adventure involved kayaking the entire 277 miles of the Grand Canyon on the Colorado River. Dangerous for anybody. And it is an accomplishment made, in a sense, at great cost and at great peril. And the story is told in a really great book called No Barriers, A Blind Man's Journey to Kayak the Grand Canyon. And No Barriers, the title of the book, also refers to an exciting program which Eric Weihenmayer helped create, which helps to create exciting and life-transforming opportunities for people who are contending with various challenges and limitations of one kind or another. The book, again, No Barriers, is published by Thomas Dunn. And Eric Weihenmayer, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much.
I'm really excited to talk with you. I should mention your previous books are Touch the Top of the World and The Adversity Advantage. You spend a fair amount of this book, and I'm glad you do, sort of setting the stage in part by talking about your own blindness. Explain briefly to our listeners when it was that you went entirely blind and what that experience was like, particularly in the moment.
Yeah, I write about, it was like winning the lottery, but the opposite. So I had this missing some genes. So nobody in my family had ever been blind or anything, but I was born visually impaired. I could see a little bit until middle school when I started losing a lot of sight. And a week before my freshman year in high school, I was totally blind. I remember being led into school that first day and thinking, I can't literally see to take a step.
Right. If I can just jump in, you tell a really cool story about watching an inspiring story on television in those last days before your blindness became complete. Tell us about the real-life figure you watched on television and the kind of inspiration that he was for you in that difficult moment.
So I was in a dark place. I could still see a little bit out of one eye just for a couple more months. I'd watch TV with my nose right up against the screen, and I watched this guy named Terry Fox. He was a phenomenon. I mean, he was a Canadian. He lost a leg to cancer. And then he made this decision, which was like the craziest decision. He decided he was going to run across Canada, thousands of miles. And I thought, you're not supposed to react that way. You know, that's you're supposed to shrink. You're supposed to kind of curl up in a ball and just protect the little bit you have left. You know, that's what happens when, you know, that when tragedy strikes. But he didn't know that. He got bigger, and he converted that darkness into something else, and he used it as energy, and he used it to propel himself forward. And, you know, Terry Fox is a hero of mine and a huge Canadian legend. And it was all based on one decision. And that really set up the message of the book and my exploration over the last 16 years trying to understand what no barriers means. Like, these counterintuitive ways that people react to these situations. They get shattered, and instead of getting smaller, they get bigger. And it's a part of that map that I think is important.
Absolutely. Back to the first days of your blindness, just for a moment. One of the most poignant things you describe in that, as you began school as a ninth grader, newly blind, completely blind, that is, although, as you said, you'd contended with vision limitations all of your life. But you describe, if I remember correctly, sitting in the cafeteria of that school and hearing kind of all the chaos and fun all around you, including a food fight erupting at one point. And, of course, you are not a part of any of this. And just the thought that you'll never be in a food fight, in a sense, was a moment in which the reality of this began to really sink in. And I just think that's so interesting how, for particularly a young person of that age, it would be something like that that would make you feel the most like you were on the outside looking in, so to speak.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so sitting in that cafeteria seat by myself at my own table, all my friends were a couple tables away in the middle of that food fight, laughing and joking. And I remember thinking, like, yeah, it's scary to go blind, not be able to see. But the real fear was being swept to the sidelines and listening to your life go by. And feeling these sort of prison bars, you know, fall down around your mind and not knowing how to get out of that, and how to break through that brick wall between, right, you know, get me back to the world. And
even if it's an ordinary life, I think that's why that leapt out at me in your book, because, you know, your book is mostly about scaling Mount Everest and then riding the rapids of the Colorado River. In this painful moment, you're not thinking about any of that. You just want to be able to access something as normal as a food fight in your high school's gymnasium or cafeteria. One of the things you do to try to sort of forge a path towards a normal full life is that you join your school's wrestling team. And this ends up being a really important part of your life. Just explain how successful you ultimately were able to be after some struggles in the early going.
Yeah, I stunk my first few years, but I got better, and it was the greatest decision I could have made, because it was my first experience being a part of something great, you know, and I think people crave to be part of things, you know, especially when you're blind and or you have some challenge and you feel isolated. So, yeah, I worked my way up to captain and represented our state and nationals, and, I turned out to be a good wrestler, but it was a lot of work, and it was a hard road.
Right, and I should think that being blind and wrestling, I mean, you were operating with a really acute disadvantage and probably had to bring all of your other skills up to the highest possible level in order to be a worthy competitor, which you turned out to be.
Yeah, it's not that much different from climbing, really, because, you know, I'm making predictions. I can't see the person's leg, but I feel their, like, wrist, and that gives me a clue where their leg might be, you know, by their body position. And climbing's the same way. You know, you can't see the rock, but you are feeling up the rock using your hands and your feet as your eyes, and you're sort of making predictions about where that next hold might be in the rock. And so, yeah, when you're blind, you're doing a lot of sort of mapping in your brain.
Well, ultimately, you are able to go on from those successes to completing college and to getting a job teaching middle school. And, of course, that was no small matter either, in that there are all kinds of principals and superintendents who are not willing to give a blind teacher a chance in a sighted environment, in a classroom of sighted students. But someone took a chance, and you ended up being a very successful and happy teacher. What was it that prompted you to leave that kind of adventure for the kind of adventures that have dominated your life since, including the scaling of Mount Everest? What sort of hunger prompted that dramatic move?
Well, I was a teacher for 6 years, and I loved it. I could have done it forever. I loved that part of my life. And I'd been climbing, though. I'd been a what you call a weekend warrior, which is like you're climbing hard on the weekends. And I started climbing bigger mountains, and I realized I couldn't do both. I couldn't teach. I wanted to make a life in the mountains. And so in 1997, I left teaching, and I tried to make my life as a blind adventurer, which there's not too many countries in the world where you can become a professional blind climber. It's not too many venture capitalist funds would have invested in that idea. But the last 20 years, that's what I've been doing. And I love it, you know, climbing around the world. I read a book called The Seven Summits by this guy named Dick Bass, and he made the Seven Summits famous. And I thought, how incredible to go around the world, every continent, experiencing these great adventures with a great team.
You ultimately, of course, managed to score this extraordinary success of scaling the summit of Mount Everest. That was back in 2001. And of course, in one of your previous books, we can hear all about that. Part of what is important for us to know in terms of your more recent adventure is something that somebody said to you as you were finishing your descent off of Mount Everest, words that you were not expecting this colleague to say to you, and words that really made a difference. Tell our listeners what was said to you and what kind of difference that made.
You come down from Everest, and, you know, people are like, oh, you shattered the world's expectations. And it's like, well, first of all, I shattered my own, because there wasn't 100% certainty that I was going to stand up there at 29,000 feet. You know, so many things came together, a great team and lots of preparation and weather. Came down the mountain and got down below it where it was the safer zone, and I knew I was going to live. And PV, our team leader, brought me aside, and he said, you know, don't make this the greatest thing you ever do. And I thought, yeah, that was really bad timing, because you're just really crushed physically and mentally. And I thought, no, let me go home and celebrate for the next 50 years. But what he was saying was, you know, these successes that we've all had, whatever they may be, you know, don't make them a funeral. Make them the launching point to more great adventure. You know, use that as a way to propel yourself towards new sort of surprising paths.
One of those that you ended up undertaking that proved to be an extraordinary experience was to return to Mount Everest with a group of blind Tibetans, young Tibetans, and taking, in a sense, then someone else on this amazing kind of journey. And it proved to be an incredible adventure, but also not easy in any way. And I so appreciate that you describe this expedition as honestly and frankly as you do, because as you say in the book, all of the complexity and difficulties really, in a sense, represented the way life so often can be, particularly for people who are faced with exceptional challenges.
Yeah, I'd gotten off this huge successful climb with Everest. You know, they called us one of the greatest teams that ever were on the mountain. And so I had this preconception now that all teams were like that. And I built this great team of Tibetan kids that were shunned by their society. You know, people spit on them in the street. And I thought, let's do something where these their villages, their families never would dream of. And let's help these kids get this really big bigness inside them, and it'll affect the trajectory of their lives. And it turns out that we struggled on that trip. You know, we had a film crew, we had the Tibetan kids, we had their teacher, Sabria, who was a beautiful lady from Germany who's blind, who ran the school, and she was worried about the kids. And we had Sherpas, who are the local people on Everest, and then, they're descendants of the Tibetans, but they're different, so everyone's fighting. And so I, off the heels of this amazing success, I have this team that's in absolute turmoil with cultural barriers and language barriers and age barriers. And ultimately, we wound up finding something meaningful, which is something you have to do a lot of times in these more typical teams. You have to find the win and the meaning for everyone. But it took a lot to get there.
One of your best lines, I think, as you are describing all of this, is something to the effect that democracy does not work on the mountain. that it's often a situation in which you simply can't have committee meetings and long involved discussions to decide what's going to happen. So,
no, as the avalanche is pouring down the mountain, you don't have time to debate sometimes. So you elect a leader. You don't even elect a leader, somebody has to be trusted to be that leader. And then you discuss, of course, as much as you can, but then that person has to weigh all the ideas and make a quick decision. And that's the safety of the mountains. You just have to have someone you trust. So, yeah, some trust broke down on that trip. And but ultimately, the good news is that these kids in Tibet are some of the most educated kids in Tibet. And they're now sending money back to their families. It's hard to be shunned and be a pariah when you're the one sending the money home to your family. And so Sabria, the blind teacher who started that project, in a dozen years sort of changed the whole reality of what disability looked like in this entire country. And I brought that idea home with me because I thought, yeah, these barriers look intractable and they're there for a reason and they've been there for a thousand years, but you can break through these things in a dozen years. It's possible.
We're speaking with Eric Weihenmayer and talking about his newest book called No Barriers, A Blind Man's Journey to Kayak the Grand Canyon. Earlier in the book, he talks about the experience of going blind as a young teenager, but then of managing to reach the summit of Mount Everest in 2001, the first and still only blind person to achieve that, and his most recent real-life adventure to kayak the Grand Canyon, 277 miles of the rapids of the Colorado River. Until I read your book, I did not stop to really ever think about how different these accomplishments were. That is, climbing a mountain and riding the wild waters of the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon are two completely different adventures. Both incredibly dangerous, but dangerous and difficult and challenging for a blind person in completely different ways. Just explain a couple of the most significant ways in which this was an adventure like none other you had ever experienced.
Well, my friend taught me how to do a roll. You get knocked over a lot of times on a kayak, and so you got to roll back up with your paddle and get yourself upright. And so it launched 6 years of training for the Grand Canyon. And, at 40 years old, starting this new project, starting this new idea, like PV had said, push forward into new terrain. And rivers were so utterly different, night and day from mountains. Mountains, you kind of have a little bit of control over your proximity. You can stop and recollect, collect yourself. Rivers, you can't do that. There's no brakes. And in fact, a lot of times you're not even fully in control. Yeah, you're sort of using the energy of the river to kind of get in position, but then there's no stopping. You just ride that energy at the river's pace and force. And it's like embracing chaos, like these, forces that are so much bigger than you. And so I remember so many times along that journey just thinking, this is so hard starting over. At 40 years old, you just feel so vulnerable. Like, Everest was supposed to teach me this great lesson and prepare me, It didn't. I felt, you know, completely just laid out there.
Hmm. Well, I mean, one would come off of Mount Everest in a sense feeling invincible, and you felt anything but invincible in this experience. And what's really quite striking is even before you get to the Colorado River, it's a harrowing experience just in terms of the training. For instance, just say a brief word about the National Whitewater Center and the kind of things that you did there and how important it was for you to return there at one point to rebuild your own confidence that had been so completely dashed.
Well, the crazy part is that I work with at No Barriers with a lot of people who get stuck, you know. So, when it gets really severe, people call it PTSD, and you get stuck in your brain. And so I went off on a river, and it was a huge flood stage, and I got over my head, and I got so scared. I could hardly get back in my kayak. I'd lost my confidence. I'd lost my combat role. And I realized I couldn't get through it, so I had to kind of back up and start over and reprogram my brain, repattern my brain. And so I went to this incredible center in Charlotte, North Carolina, where you can – it's a man-made river. It's a concrete river, and they actually pour water down it with pumps and then pump the water back up. And they have all these features underneath the water, these barriers and drop-offs that create the rapids. And so you can go over and over and over down these things and map out the rapid and really focus on your technique. And by doing that, I kind of rebuilt myself.
Hmm. And in the midst of this adventure involving the Grand Canyon and the Colorado River, you also spend some time in the book talking about adopting a son from Nepal. I think it's a really intriguing and wonderful choice that you make to include that in the book as you do, even though on the surface it seems to have nothing to do with this this latest undertaking. Tell us why it was so important to you to include this story in this book.
Well, I'm smiling right now because I'm so glad that you noticed that it wasn't random. You know, barriers are barriers, right? And we have different threads that run through our lives, and one of them is family. And when you get in your 40s, I have two beautiful kids. At the time, I had one beautiful kid, and we wanted to bring a boy home to bring into our family. And that adventure, those barriers were more complex than ever in a mountain or a river. It's just like the bureaucracy, when you read the book, it's like it's just the craziest thing in the world. Thank God I had my wife, who's very, very aggressive and can, you know, really think things through step by step, because we were in the middle of a civil war in Nepal, and adoptions had stopped, and so you're trying to, like, get to the right appointments, and you're walking through streets on fire, you know, burning tires, bricks on fire flying over your head, and you're like, AK-47s pointed everywhere, and you're like, I need to get to my embassy appointment. You mind if I step around your AK-47? So it was a wild adventure bringing this guy home.
And it's a story, of course, that ultimately ends happily, as does your wild, dangerous ride down the Colorado River, which, of course, we can follow in your book. One of my favorite...
I hope I'm not giving away anything, but the blind guy lives.
Lives to tell about it. One of my favorite lines in the book is this: I'd grown up with defined rules of what a blind person could and could not do, and I knew what that blanket felt like as it lowered down and began to suffocate you. My whole life, I'd been trying to break free of it and do something bold and unexpected. You have certainly done that time and time again, and we read about it in your wonderful new book called No Barriers, A Blind Man's Journey to Kayak the Grand Canyon, published by Thomas Dunn Books. Eric Weyenmeyer, I thank you so much for joining me and for talking about your marvelous book. And if people want to explore something about your program called No Barriers, where can they find more information?
Yeah, go to nobarriersusa.org, and you can read about all our programs. We have one coming up this summer in Squaw Creek, California. We'll have 1,000 people all celebrating ways they break through barriers in their life.
Wonderful. Eric Weinmeier, thank you again for joining me today on The Morning Show. This was fun.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I am honored to welcome into our studios for the first time Dr. John Swallow, the new president of Carthage College. On Friday, Guida Brown, director of the Hope Council's a Council for Alcohol and Other Drug Abuse. And on Monday, we'll preview for you a POV documentary, actually receiving an encore presentation called Two Towns of Jasper, concerning a racial hate crime which occurred in Jasper, Texas back in 1998. It's a very thoughtful examination of the racial dynamics and tensions in this small town. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock.